the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. Here's your host, Jim Poplava.
Well, in this age of epidemic that we're going through as a country, as many states and all of us are could be quarantined or locked down, how do we stay in touch? Well, one way is social media, which is the topic of today's program. Joining me on the program is Dr. Pamela Rutledge. She's director of the Media Psychology Research Center. You know, one of the things that I have found fascinating, Pamela, is our own company is sort of prepared for these kind of things. We've had things like fires in San Diego, and we've been able to operate remotely because of this technology, whether we have Zoom meetings for conferences or conferences with staff or clients. It's one way that we're able to stay in touch. Let's talk about that in this new age that we're living in.
Yeah, I think it's super important right now. What we're seeing is that technology has allowed us to go through a very, very difficult period without the level of stress that we would have if we were truly isolated. I mean, think about the sheltering at home, how many people are able to work from home, and I don't want to diminish the pain of those who are not able to, but it's allowed some portion of the economy to maintain functioning. It's allowed some portion of us to, as you stay in touch with our family and friends. Last night we had a Zoom meeting among my extended family because normally this would be our family reunion. So it allows us to have this element of real life or element of connectivity that we would not otherwise be able to have.
So things like Zoom, GoToMeetings, obviously, it's enabling us to stay in touch with each other, but it's also changing, I think, the way we're going to be doing business. I think a lot of major corporations have announced, you know, do I really need to put my employees on an airplane, take the risk, send them to some place across the country or across the pond, and spend all that money when we can accomplish and be just as effective and do it in a Zoom meeting or a GoToMeeting?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's something that is this catastrophic causes us to reevaluate a lot of the fundamental assumptions we have about the quote unquote right way of doing things. And certainly there are times when if you're in business that sitting around in person with people is important. But there are an awful lot of other things that are informational or check-ins that can be done very easily virtually. I was speaking to someone the other day and they said, I feel so much less stress about my schedule because I used to feel really guilty about having to cancel a meeting when something else came up. But now I know that people are just sitting by their computers and I don't worry so much about making them walk someplace or drive someplace. So there's all these little tiny things that we weren't thinking about before that now we're starting to use as a cost-benefit analysis. So I think it makes a really big difference. Another thing I wanted to just add is that there's a big psychological implication about this kind of experience, being separated, being isolated. And anything that we can do, even if it's not as good as being in touch personally, anything we can do to alleviate that sense of isolation is a very positive thing from a mental health perspective.
And I think that's really important, don't you think, Doctor, for, let's say, if you have elder parents who, you know, miss seeing their kids or grandkids, to stay in touch with them so they don't feel isolated and alone.
Absolutely. And, you know, I mean, I had to kind of chuckle to myself as you were saying that, because it only took me about 3 hours to get my my mother on Zoom. But once you do that, she feels so liberated. She's actually connecting with her, you know, with her friends for her newsletter committee and checking in with grandchildren. And she's actually having more contact with grandchildren because of learning to use Zoom than she was before because they're so geographically spread out. So her experience is actually more positive in terms of that connectivity right now. She's in a retirement home. Kids are all over the place. So we forget that there are things that reality fell short and technology's filling in.
So let's talk about that technology because, you know, today kids growing up, when I was growing up, we were always outside on the playground doing things. Today kids are, you know, my 2-year-old granddaughter is growing up on an iPad. So they're on their iPads, they're playing games, they're doing things, and there seems to be less socialization, one-on-one, being around people. Let's talk about that. Is that necessarily good?
Well, you know, first of all, I think we need to make a big distinction between one-on-one and, you know, that kind of thing, because my 9-year-old stepdaughter plays games with her friends all the time. So there's a massive community within the game, as if they were sitting around a Monopoly board. So these games are not always isolating. And I also think that we need to remember that everything's about balance, whether it's technology or ice cream, right? In other words, you learn different things in different places, but I'll tell you, there are kids learning all kinds of things about strategy and math and collaboration in ways that they never did before because of gaming environments.
You recently wrote an article, now that a lot of us are basically quarantined, we stay in our homes, we're not going out like we used to, the risk of watching the news. And I read that part, and it was funny because last night, the news was so terrible that after about a half an hour in it, I just, you know, I just turned it off. I just didn't want to hear any more bad news.
Well, smart you for recognizing that everything has limits. You know, there's a theory called the mean world syndrome that says that if we watch too much negative news, we start to think that the world is a lot worse than it actually is. And right now, the world is pretty crazy and chaotic. So it's pretty bad out there. So it's very important to recognize when you're taking in news, when you're actually getting information that's useful, and when you're just allowing what's bad out there to elevate your anxiety. And so I think it's very important to say, do I need this information? Is this new information? If not, do exactly what you did. Switch over to Netflix and watch, you know, a comedy for a while, because you're not gaining anything and you actually could be hurting yourself by elevating your stress level.
Yeah, because the one thing that we're in today is a 24-hour news cycle. If some event happens, it's just played over and over and over over a 24-hour news cycle. So, I mean, there's only so much that you can take of seeing that. I want to talk about something else that is changing. I mean, prior to COVID, we had restaurants, we had movie theaters, we had shopping malls. So when the weekend came, there were so many things that you had available that you could do socially. Meet friends for dinner, maybe go out to a movie with your spouse, maybe go to a mall or shopping, go to a sporting event. All of those things are not available. A lot of them are being shut down. I don't even know what this year's NFL football season is going to look like. They just reported like close to 60 players have COVID.
Yeah, there certainly are a lot of choices that are gone. It's going to be uncomfortable for a while, but at a certain point, some of these things will come back, but maybe not in the way that we know them. Now, interestingly, technology has filled in some gaps. There have been a lot of YouTube videos watched where people are learning new hobbies. In fact, matter of fact, I saw the other day that butter churning had been, you know, a big uptick, that people were churning the butter. So people are actually finding really interesting and innovative and creative ways of entertaining themselves, expanding their knowledge, learning something they didn't know. But you're right. If we focus on what we can't do, then it becomes anxiety provoking and stressful. So it's much more important to focus on what we can do and look for ways around that. Sure, you can't go to a restaurant, but you actually can take a walk outside as long as you have a mask and you're maintaining social distancing, so that there are things that you can do. And it's important not to think you can't do anything. It's just sort of evaluate each thing to based upon what it is that it makes sense.
You know, it's interesting that you say that, because being quarantined, in my profession, I have to have continuing education. So during this period of time, I'm pursuing a second master's degree.
Well, good
and,
for you.
Yeah, and I actually find it challenging and fun and doing something new. So I'm turning something that's negative, you know, just sitting around the house, into something that's positive. So you mentioned people are going on YouTube, they're picking up hobbies or learning how to do things. Let's talk more about that, because this is a time where you can actually be very productive.
Oh, absolutely. There was a very funny ad with Ryan Reynolds, the comedian, for a phone company. And he was saying, well, you know, it was the pandemic and I was going to write a book and I was going to be a better parent. And he was going through this long list of these things that we always tell ourselves that we're going to do. But of course, he didn't do any of them. But the point is that we have the time to actually pick some of these things. And so I would recommend to people, if they're feeling stymied and they're sick of watching Netflix, that they start to journal, or they start to do something that's just sort of the thin edge of the wedge into some kind of activity, and journal about what you always wanted to do. Do a little sort of self-exploration now that we have all this time on our hands. My nephew's planting a garden of sunflower seeds or sunflowers so we can sell sunflower seeds at the farmer's market in the fall. You know, so people are really doing interesting things.
Yeah, I mean, I've taken up cooking, and I find that kind of fun to come up with a new recipe rather than, let's say, going out to dinner as often as we used to. So, I mean, there are things that you can do. Let's talk about how all this technology comes together and is infused in our life. I mean, the other night, just before I was getting ready to go to sleep, I had this routine I have to go through. I have one iPad that I use for my podcast that needs to be charged. I have a portable iPad Pro, which also needs to be charged, a laptop, a phone, a watch. I mean, all these electronic gizmos that weren't, and then my earbuds. So, I mean, there's seven or eight things that I have to be charged right now. I mean, think about 20 years ago, that wasn't our life. Maybe you might have had a desktop computer, but certainly not all the devices we have today.
No, and your desktop computer probably wouldn't have lasted more than about 30 minutes if you'd unplugged it. Yeah, you know, there's all of these things really are, in some senses, they're confining, right? Because you just described, I have to charge all these things. On the other hand, when you have your AirPods in, you can walk anywhere that you want talking. You can take a telephone call, you know, without being connected to the wall. Think about, in a funny kind of way, how much gasoline that saves when people are picking each other up at the airport. In other words, there's all these little things. So yes, there are constraints on one end, but what's the benefit, or what's that enabling us to do the other 23 hours where they're not charging, where we have this mobility and flexibility to access information, to, you know, you want a new recipe? You don't have to, you know, look through all your cookbooks. You can go online and Google and see how five different people make the same thing and make your own recipe out of that. So the benefits of these things, the access to information, the freedom of movement, are pretty profound.
Yeah, I mean, it's just amazing. I use my cell phone as a dictionary. You can Google anything. You have a question, you just call in Siri, and then all of a sudden you have an answer and multiple sources of information for anything that you want to look into.
Right, which means you're not spending your time searching through. You're spending your time using information. In other words, you're using the thing that your brain does best, thinking, not searching.
But what about, I want to talk about some of the negative aspects of a lot of this stuff that we have. And one of the things that really struck me is I needed to get my hair cut, and I finally found a place that was open to get my hair cut. The owner of the salon texted me a message, and in that message was the address. When I went to type it into my Google system to drive there, I got halfway through the address and Google put the entire address, including the suite number. So, you know, what about privacy in this age that we live in? Because that really struck me. How did they know the suite number and the address when I didn't even type all the numbers of the address?
Yeah, I think the privacy is going to be increasingly a big issue as people are starting to realize that all of the things that support our ability to search, as you say, there's algorithms that search databases and provide information. Now, some information, like if you're running a business, you actually want people to know where you're located. And the suite number is a pretty valuable piece of information. On the other hand, I really don't want people knowing my social security number. So we're going to start to see people becoming much smarter about demanding privacy and demanding files and protection over certain types of information. What we've been doing all along is we've been giving away our information for the use of other technologies, but most people aren't aware that they're making that trade-off. Companies are going to have to start adjusting and providing some of that security.
What about when it comes to social media? You know, we see sometimes it has a deleterious effect with, for example, somebody says something, and then all of a sudden there's this storm of tweets where, you know, somebody could lose a job or they're just battered on social media. What about those aspects? It's almost like this mob psychology that takes over.
Right. Well, cancel culture I've heard it called. You know, mob behavior is not a new phenomenon, right? I mean, throughout history, somebody gets other people riled up and then they do terrible things. I think we're seeing that a lot right now, partly because of the level of frustration and anxiety and lack of control that people feel, so that they're much easier to incite, shall we say, and they're much more interested in trying to find somebody to blame for something. So I think it's important to be aware that there's this climate out there of that's very negative, and not allow yourself to be sucked into it. I agree with you that that's problematic. I think that social media companies are going to have to start regulating a little more. I'm not totally in favor of people telling us what we can say, but there have to be limits in terms of polite discourse or just downright falsehoods. So I think there's going to be some very uneasy negotiation that goes on as we try to establish good citizenship or the golden rule in a digital world.
What about also the aspects of how people get their news? And a lot of people get their news in social media. I mean, at one time, Doctor, we had the three major networks. You had your major newspapers, the Washington Times, the New York Times, the Washington Post. And that's where we got our information. Today, people are more reliant on social media for news. And they don't necessarily, I don't think, have the critical thinking sometimes to judge whether the news that they're reading is accurate or it's more of a somebody's viewpoint or it has a lot of inaccuracies to it.
Yeah, that's a great point. And one of the things that, you know, we've had all this technology happen very quickly in terms of the human timeline. When we give people the keys to the car, we ask them to go through driver's training. But we've got all the social media, which is incredibly powerful, and we don't actually train people to do that critical thinking that you're talking about. We don't train people to understand how the web works, how information is pulled, how algorithms work, how you can live in a bubble just because of what you search for gets fed back to you. So I think part of the solution to that is media literacy at a very young age, all the way up through. The other is that people have to take responsibility for the information that they get. This is very difficult because we all like to hear stuff that we agree with. So we have an innate cognitive bias to seek out and believe the stuff that confirms our own worldview. So this is going to be a continual struggle.
How do you teach people media literacy? I mean, we have the same problem in the investment business. If you're bullish, you know, you're more inclined to read articles or reports by bullish analysts. You know, in order to balance that, we get research information from people that we don't necessarily agree to. It kind of gives us a balance to weigh the bullish versus the bearish. How do you get that media literacy or critical thinking into children or even adults today?
Well, I think it's easier with children than adults because adults have had a long time to believe what they believe. You know, somebody said the reason entrepreneurs are young is because they don't have to unlearn all the stuff that they don't know yet. Media literacy is really taught best independent of technology. It's really taught best about talking about these sort of concepts and exercises where kids have sort of tangible proof. What does it mean, for example, to take all of your information and put it in a shoebox on the sidewalk? If you ask kids to do that, they'll go, "That's crazy. Why would I want to do that? And they said, well, what do you think you're doing when you put all your stuff up on Facebook? So I have a very dear friend who runs actually an organization that creates media literacy programs for middle school students. Her company is CyberWise, and her whole program is really designed with lessons that have very little to do with using technology to teach the lessons, but have you to do with the lessons that you need to use technology.
So is this something that they can even put into, let's say, a grade school curriculum?
Absolutely.
Yeah, because, I mean, I was taught critical thinking, multiple languages when I was going through school. And I thank goodness that I was taught that critical thinking, because I can read something in the media and I can maybe question it and say, mm-hmm. you know, that doesn't sound right to me. I'm going to go and look for maybe another source or double check what I'm reading. And then in the investment business, it's critical.
Absolutely, yes, because you're stopping to think, what is this information actually trying to persuade me to do? What is the agenda of the person who's giving me this information? And once you start asking those kind of questions, where did it come from? What is it that they want? You start to see the information a little bit differently so that you can make a better judgment about the validity. And then the other thing is the triangulation. The one thing that we can do very easily on the web is say, okay, there's a piece of information. Let me check and see where I can validate that. Does anybody else say this, or is this just, you know, a random, you know, rumor? So it's a good tool for critical thinking if you're willing to expend the effort. But back to your point about people get a lot of information news on social media. Getting your news on Facebook is not the most accurate way to get news.
Yeah, I mean, there's established media sources out there that have some credibility. I mean, for us, I mean, we get alternative research reports. We've got publications from overseas. So we just don't even rely on, you know, sources like the Wall Street Journal. We mm-hmm. look at The Economist. We look at the Financial Times, because it gives you a different perspective, you know, a European or a global view of things, not just what we hear in the U.S. How can one do that, the average person? Is there a book that you can read about this? Is there something, a course you can take about social media, how to use it, how to criticize it, how to analyze it, versus, let's say, you know, for most people, they just they find one source and that becomes their source of information and that's it.
Well, if parents are interested in teaching, dealing with their children in social media, I recommend the book Raising Humans in the Digital Age, I think it's called, by Diana Graber. It's a very no-nonsense, no political agenda, very practical, how to deal with the problems that come up and the issues that come up so that you equip kids to be responsible digital citizens. So I think that that's a great resource for the sort of general foundation of media literacy. There are other books out there on media literacy. I think what you don't want to do is look for a book on how to use social media, because social media changes all the time. What you're really looking for is some fundamental ideas and the issues that appear no matter what the technology, no matter what the platform. In other words, if you trained everybody, you know, how to use Facebook, and then you find out your kid's on TikTok, like, uh-oh, right? You know, I mean, and by the time you figure out TikTok, God knows where they'll be. So what's important is that they start to understand very basic concepts about information creation, the responsibility of sharing, how to think about impact, think about media, the agenda of different pieces of information, and how to navigate that.
You know, something else I think that's really important, and we as an employer have had to go through this, where if we're getting ready to hire somebody, we go on social media and kind of try to get a feel for who that person is. Doctor, I wonder if you might address of some of the things that, you know, younger kids do. Maybe you're in high school and you do some things on social media that you might regret later on in life.
Absolutely. And that's one of the key lessons in media literacy, is understanding that the internet is permanent. It's searchable, and little bits of information are easy to take out of context. So when kids start to realize that they're being checked on by others, it's a real eye opener to them. And if you teach them that early, if you say to them, hey, you know, do you think I'd let you just come over and play with my kid without looking at your Facebook page? The thought that some mom looking at their Facebook page floors them. Because we have this tendency, all of us, when we are doing something public, like on Facebook, we are just imagining the people that we normally talk to. We are imagining our friends. We are not imagining, nor can we cognitively comprehend, the magnitude of public as it exists today. So those kind of lessons can be really important and really pivotal and really change the trajectory of social media engagement for kids all the way through.
Yeah, because that's really important, because, you know, the way you might think as a young adult or a teenager, 14 to 16, the things you might post on your Facebook page or even in your early years of college. I mean, look how, for example, even in the political realm, where it's been discovered pictures or things that politicians did in their college days that they probably regret, you know, 10, 15, 20 years later in their career.
Right. Yeah. And they were, you know, of course, the context of the time, it isn't the context of this time. So, yeah, I think that's really important. I always think of it as the grandma rule. You know, don't do anything on social media that you don't want to share with your grandma. And, you know, and the elevator rule, which is don't say anything in the elevator you don't want someone you don't know to hear, right? Because they can hear. I mean, and both of those things are true. And if you think about it like that, then it helps you to sort of curate what you want to share so that you aren't oversharing. Because I don't care what the best privacy settings are in the world, it is not private. There is a way to get in.
Yeah, that's what really surprised me when Google picked up on this address from a text halfway typing through the numbers. I mean, so that's what people don't realize. These algorithms, whether it's Google, Facebook, Twitter, or anybody else's program, you're being watched, listened to, and read.
And tracked, right? In other words, haven't you ever, you've looked up something on the internet and then you go to another website and then you get shown an ad for something that you just looked for, right? People are tracking your behavior, not against your name, but against your IP address, to show you, to target you with ads, to target you with information. And so the only way around that is to take actions to learn more about it, to use browsers that can't be tracked, to delete cookies, do all of those things, but also to be aware that that's happening.
Yeah, I mean, that used to drive me crazy. I'd be looking at something and then all of a sudden all my ads on the Wall Street Journal or some other publication I was reading all reflected what my recent searches were. So, you know, I found a way to get around that is I now use a browser that is non-trackable.
Right.
And now I don't have to worry about that, that if I'm going to the Wall Street Journal, I'm not going to see ads at something I was looking at.
Right, yeah. So the browser for anybody listening, DuckDuckGo, is not trackable. DuckDuckGo.
Yeah, that's exactly what I use. I just want to, it's called Duck, D-U-C-K, DuckDuckGo.
Right.
Yeah, and it's a way to get rid of some of this and maybe add a little bit more privacy.
Change your passwords a lot. Don't use the same, you know, don't use your birthday or your dog's name on everything.
Okay. One final question. And when you are consulting with companies in terms of social media, because we've seen where some company chairman or somebody in the company says something and then immediately on social media, you know, there's protest and, you know, we're going to protest against this company or that company. When you're dealing with corporations, what are their number one concerns when it comes to social media?
Well, I think everyone has a lot of concerns. What I would say is don't start with your concerns. Start with the social media policy. Start with a policy so that it's uniform in your organization. Have a policy for how you handle problems. Look at how other people have handled problems, because I think the biggest mistake that companies make is that they forget that their employees are really part of their customer service, no matter what job they have. that all of that is part of their brand, and so that they don't establish sort of a team effort, and that they think that if a mistake happens or somebody puts their foot in their mouth, that they could just keep their heads down and it'll go away. It does not. You have to have strategies for dealing with those things. You have to step in, you have to own it, and you have to fix it. The faster you do that, the better it goes. So it isn't, we all make mistakes. Everybody gets that. We all love a redemption story. Just don't ignore it. And that's where you see the real damage.
Well, fabulous. Well, Doctor, I really appreciate you coming on the program. A lot of great stuff. And like I said, we live in this digital age. And once again, will you give out that name of that book? Is it Raising Humans in a Digital Age by
Diana Graber.
Diana Graber. Fabulous. And Doctor, if people like to follow your work, how could they do so?
They could look on my website, PamelaRutledge.com.
All right. Well, Doctor, thanks so much for coming on the program. It was a real pleasure.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
You betcha. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Please be advised that you invest at your own risk.